Okay. Oh.
We're good?
Just a second. Ready.
All right, well, if we're ready to go, I'd like to call this meeting of the Salem Airport Advisory Commission to order. And Darcy, if you can lead us off with a roll call.
John Foley.
Here.
Doug Brandeiser.
Here.
Lieutenant, Colonel, sorry, Edgecombe.
Here.
Brendan O'Mara.
Present.
Ken Geddes.
Here.
Neil White.
Here.
Kat Pence is excused.
All right. So moving on to the first item on the agenda, or the second item, we'd like to approve the agenda. Has everybody had a chance to, have they received it and had a chance to review the agenda?
Yes.
And are any additions or changes needed? All right, if not, is there a motion to approve the agenda as distributed?
Neil White, I would like to make a motion to approve the agenda.
Doug Brenneiser will second it.
All right, well then we'll do a roll call vote. Doug Brenneiser? Indicate if you're in favor of...
Thank you. I've got a great memory, it's just very short. I'm in favor.
All right. Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe.
Aye.
Brendan O'Mara.
Aye.
Ken Geddes.
Aye.
Neil White.
Aye.
And John Foley votes in favor, aye. All right, moving on to the next item. Has everyone received and reviewed the minutes from the October 21st meeting?
Yes.
Yes.
And
yes.
Are there any corrections yes. needed? All right, if not, is there a motion to approve the minutes as distributed?
Doug Brenneiser, so motions.
All right.
Neil White seconds.
All right. We'll do another roll call vote. Indicate if you're in favor of approving the minutes as distributed. Doug Brenneiser.
Aye.
Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe.
Aye.
Brendan O'Mara.
Aye.
Ken Geddes.
Aye.
Neil White.
Aye.
And John Foley votes aye. All right, so those minutes have been approved. Moving on to the next agenda item, which would typically be public comment, but as we mentioned at the start of the meeting or prior to the meeting, we haven't gotten any comments from the public that we solicited prior. So we'll just continue on with the reports, which is the next agenda item. And the first item on tower or reports would be the tower chief reports, and I believe that was part of the airport advisory packet that was distributed. Were there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think the tower report was distributed with the packet. Rob Broyhill from the tower sent me his notes to read. He wasn't able to attend tonight.
Okay.
I believe that was part of the packet. So if you'll allow me, I'll just go ahead and read Rob's notes.
Sure thing, thank you.
Our chief report. Okay, first, 2020 traffic count, calendar year 2020 traffic count, they noted 38,970 operations for the year. Again, they count theirs a little bit differently than we count ours for airport operations because they also count overflights through the airspace. So airport operations for the year were 37,500. Both our numbers and the tower numbers were about 2,000 or so less than last year. But considering the spring lockdowns for the coronavirus and then the 10 days or 2 weeks out of forest fires, I think actually if we were to have had a normal year, we would have had well over 40,000 operations. It would have been a very robust year. It's actually recovered pretty nicely later in the year from the early lockdown. So pretty happy with those numbers, although they are short from the year prior. The next item Rob has is air traffic mandatory occurrence reports. These are events that require reporting to the FAA. They did have one bird strike noted on, this would just be for the calendar quarter, which was since the last AAC, so October, November, December. One bird strike on December 3rd, the Pilatus PC-12 departing runway 31 struck a bird and did have some damage to its de-icing boots. They had three vehicle pilot deviations, two vehicle deviations. They were both from the same tenant on the north end. Vehicle entered taxiway Kilo and taxiway Charlie without authorization. My investigation indicated that there was a new person on the north end that had not completed their driver training, was not familiar with the airfields. I think we've solved that one, but they were issued notices of violation and did complete their driver training since then. So I think we solved that. That was on October 25th and then again on November 9th. And then we had a pilot deviation on December 20th. An RV-8 entered Class Delta airspace, that's the airspace around Salem Airport, without establishing two-way radio communication. The tower spotted the aircraft on a half-mile final to runway 31. Tower personnel were unable to establish communication with the pilot and the aircraft landed at the airport without clearance. That's a big one. He did note one aircraft accident. It was off airport. Also, I was on December 3rd, a TECNAM, and I had to look up what a TECNAM was. I was not familiar with that. It's an Italian aircraft manufacturer. A TECNAM aircraft radioed Salem Tower reporting an engine failure north of Kaiser. The aircraft was able to successfully land in a field. Tower personnel were able to assist, solicit aircraft in the area to spot the position of the aircraft, to provide updates to law enforcement and emergency personnel to the location, and there were no injuries reported from that crash. That is good news. Under equipment, Rob wanted to let us know there are two long-term cranes, construction cranes, operating in the vicinity of the airport. We have one that's 0.4 miles northeast of runway 16 over near Hawthorne Avenue, I believe it is. And then another one operating 1.4 miles northwest of runway 13. Both of those at 376 feet MSL. So those cranes will be there for several months. We do have some taxiway edge lights that are still out of service. They're out of service over on Bravo, Mike, Golf, November, and Quebec. So essentially all the taxiways on the east side of the airport. And that's because we had a failure of one of our regulators in our electrical vault. There's a part that failed and we've ordered a new one, but it hasn't yet made it here. So those are notably out of service. That's over on the guard Garmin side of the airfield. And then the FAA has their runway alignment indicator lights on the instrument, the ILS instrument landing system, the rails are out of service. So that's notably as well. And then under staffing, Rob has noted that his new tower personnel are finishing up their training here at the end of January, and then he has another tower personnel, did not give me a name, so I don't know who it is, that it will be retiring in February. So then presumably he'll have more new staff to train in the spring. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, that is the one page of tower manager report that I was provided.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Do we have any questions related to the tower report? All right, if not, then we can move on to the airport manager report. John, I believe you included all that in their packet.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did include my comments in the packet. I would add, because I got a couple of questions subsequent to that, there is a project that's happening in our north parking lot between our terminal and FedEx. It's not an airport project. It's a public works stormwater drainage project that's happening over there. But I did not include that in my notes, so I wanted to just throw that out there as an updated report. No cost to the airport, but certainly some benefit in terms of drainage and vehicle access and egress.
Okay.
Other than that, I did include my packet, but I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody else has anything they're interested in knowing about.
Any questions for John on his report?
Doug Brennan, just a comment. The work on the taxiways and so forth looks pretty impressive. That's going to be quite a project, isn't it?
You're talking about the Summers Taxiway Rehabilitation Project?
That's right.
It will be, yep.
Yeah, that's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, we really lucked out there. So we were awarded out of the president's budget for, I think it's 3 years in a row, they had some supplemental airport funding, and we were not successful the first 2 years at getting any of that supplemental funding, but we were successful in the third year, which is great because the concrete portion of Taxiway Charlie in particular, which was the original grant application, is really in pretty poor condition, and it's very difficult to fix concrete patches that are coming apart. So that's a big one. And then we're allowed to do some other additional pieces too. So it's a big project. And really the nice thing about that, I noted that in my my report here, is that the typically there's a 10% match that we're required to match for a federal grant. But the Coronavirus CARES Act funding is actually providing airport matches for federally funded projects. So this is actually a project that is going to be zero cost to the airport, and it's going to be quite a bit of taxiway rehabilitation. So I'm really, really happy about that.
Good news.
Once in a great while win.
Any other questions for John? I did actually have one question for you.
Okay.
And it had to do with this, two questions, I guess. One, I was noticing the noise reports.
Yes.
And they have a column there for number of households, and it shows one. Is that interpreted to mean that for all of 2020, the six noise complaints were all from the same household?
I would say yes, although I, oh, here we go. No, so I think if you look down a number of households, there was one in January, one in March. So there were six households total if you go to the bottom of the page.
Okay, so I was misinterpreting that. I was
told. Okay, yeah, so we had six separate households, it looks like. Yeah, so six complaints. It looks like they were from six separate households, if I'm reading that correctly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a tricky matrix to read. Thanks for asking.
Hey, and this is Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe on that topic. Sorry to interrupt on this. I know you have a second question, but I did have a question on how are they identifying that they're guard helos? And I can tell you from experience that I'll be talking with somebody wherever. And when I'm telling them about, you know, what I do or whatever, and they're like, oh, I saw you guys fly over my house yesterday, you know? I said, are you sure? And then they say, oh, yeah, your helicopter was loud and blah, blah, blah. And well, I happen to know for a fact, you know, the previous day we didn't have anybody out flying that day. All aircraft were home in bed. And I'm just kind of curious to know how you guys are tracking and confirming that they're guard aircraft.
There is a good question, Colonel. There really is no way for us to know for sure. We only log the complaint based on the information that we're provided. There's no way for us to confirm or deny. Typically, if it's a guard complaint, we'll also give them your ops number for them to contact your folks over there to get more information. But at that point, we just log it based on what we're told. So it could very well be a non-guard helicopter that's just logged in our system as a guard helicopter, and it might not be. Could be based on a sound somebody heard. It sounded like a Black Hawk, and it wasn't, but we don't have any way to know that.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe that's something we can discuss in the future, is maybe changing that to military or something. I mean, do you remember a year and a half ago, I think it was, a couple of Chinook helicopters out of JBLM flew over Salem at 500 feet, and, you know, we got tagged with a whole bunch of phone calls and complaints, and
yes.
Not us.
Yes, you are correct. Yeah, let's talk about that going forward, how we can better track that. Maybe we can just identify it as military. You're right. We actually had some Apaches and some other Blackhawks that were regular Army came through the last couple of weeks, and we didn't receive any noise complaints on those in particular, but it's an example of an opportunity for a noise complaint that would not be guard related. So yeah,
and all right. And I hate for us to, and we fly neighborly. We are very good about treating our neighbors because we live here too. So
you are, and actually that's true. And I'll tell you that most of the folks I talk to are very forgiving, and they really aren't complaining as much as they're just letting us know that it happened. They particularly get cranky at nighttime, and sometimes, especially in the summertime, you have to fly late at night because the sun sets so late. So a lot of folks don't actually want to file a complaint. They just want to ask why it was so late, and so we provide that information. But
yeah, all right, I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. It's good. It's good information and good feedback. And I'd also let you know too that the primary purpose for tracking these is really just for us to see a trend. If we see a certain type of aircraft, or if we recognize that it's maybe from a certain household, what we're trying to determine is if there's some kind of a noise issue in the community that we need to address in a particular location. So really, this is just a tracking mechanism for trends more so than trying to pinpoint any at-fault aircraft, if that makes sense.
Terrific. Thank you.
Great. Yep. We'll talk.
All right.
John, did you have another question?
I did. I was just wondering if there are any updates on the Small Community Air Service Development Grant. I know your report says you should get something from the consultant here shortly, and the due date's the next Tuesday, I think.
Yeah, so actually, thank you for bringing that up. That is correct. So since the time that I sent my report out, we were notified by the Air Service Development Consultant that the community uses that the due date for the applications has now been extended to March 1st. And then the program has increased from a total of $13 million available up to $18 million available. So it's a bigger pot of money to compete for, and we have more time. So our application is essentially complete, but we won't submit it now until probably the last week of February or so. We don't want to submit it too early, and certainly we don't want to wait for the last day. So that's been pushed out now. So about 6 more weeks. Yep. Now, what that'll likely mean is it'll be later in the year or later than it would have been before we get the results, find out if we are successful with that application or not. But I would still anticipate maybe we would know by the end of the calendar year or early 22. But you never know with those. It's federal programs.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you for that reminder.
Are there any other questions related to the airport manager report? All right, if there aren't, John, I think you had a presentation that you put together for the city council that you wanted to share with us. Were you?
I did. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me, I apologize if anybody was listening live on YouTube. We're listening to John Pascal Hour. This is turning. But let me get my screen sharing set up here so that everybody can see my screen. I can walk through this with you. And I'm going to click off of my own video here. And okay. Is everybody able to see the screen here? It's got a, you can see my mouse on it. It says Salem Municipal Airport presentation to Salem Council video.
Coming clear here.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, fantastic. So I'm gonna kind of step through this. Now, when we get to the actual city council workshop, there will be 3 of us that will be presenting, but because I'm here flying solo tonight, so it's going
to
be all
is everybody able to see the screen here? It's got a...
But the intent here is that this is a city council
work-related economic development airport 101 workshop.
Okay, fantastic. So I'm going to kind of step
for January of 2020.
Now, when we get to the actual city council workshop, it was then postponed to half a dozen or so times that will be presenting several times. Really, because the city council just ended up in one of these years and had to focus on the homeless crisis.
But the intent here is that this is a city
civil unrest and that's
wildfire-related economic development.
It's been a busy year for the city council. Originally, the schedules got deferred
for January. Of course, there was elections,
but it was then postponed to
time or so.
It worked out pretty well several times now. Because the city council ended up in one of these years and had to focus on the
homeless crisis downtown
and the pandemic. And much the same with the unrest,
we may have some wildfires. It's been a busy year for the city council. So I wanted to share this with the AAC so that you'd be aware of what we were going to be presenting to city council. This is still in draft form. I'll go with that caveat. Some of these slides may change a little bit, but I don't think they'll change much. And some of these you'll recognize past discussions we've had in AAC meetings related to, you know, the pappies and the trees and things that we'll touch on here. It's all sort of culminated, and we kind of wrapped all these up into one presentation so that we can talk about them as kind of an airport-wide topic. So I would invite everybody in the commission and anybody in the public to attend the February 16th virtual workshop. I assume it will be virtual. I don't have any other information except that it's February 16th, and I do believe it's at 6 o'clock at night as well. But I'll make sure that everybody has the links, and I would encourage you to attend. And then any questions or clarifications or anything you have tonight will help us, because they may be ones that we can anticipate that the city council may be interested in too. So I'm walking through this sort of on behalf of the team, and the next slide where we'll start with this is just going to be the agenda. The agenda will just be the introduction of the team. We'll talk a little bit about Airport 101, get into some trends in aviation that we're tracking, talk a little bit about airport challenges and opportunities going forward, and then a little bit on urban renewal. And so if we get to the team introduction, that will be these folks. You may recognize Kristen Rutherford. She is the Urban Development Director. The airport is organized under the Urban Development Department. So she is my boss. And then myself, of course, the airport manager, and then Mitch Hooper. Mitch is the aviation manager for Mead & Hunt. Mead & Hunt is the airport's aviation consulting firm for airport planning, research, engineering, architecture. They help manage all of our construction projects. They're on a five-year agreement with us. And so they're helping us through this presentation with the council as well. A little bit of Airport 101. This won't be a surprise to many of you, but just a little bit of information. And I really want to do a photo credit here, but I can't remember off the top of my head who sent me this photo. It was last spring. It's a beautiful photo of the airport. It might have been Kat, but she's not here tonight for me to ask. It might have been J.P. McLaughlin, but in any case, I will get a photo credit. But the airport generally, 751-acre airport, it's home to more than 130 aircraft hangars and businesses, which employ over 550 people. Airport operations include maintenance of roughly 100 acres of paved surfaces, the remaining 650 acres of grounds, an extensive airfield lighting system, three airport buildings, the terminal building, the restaurant building, and then the weather service building all belong to the city. And then keeping the facility compliant with FAA standards for commercial service airports. And we do all of that with 4.5 full-time employees. So it's myself, an operations specialist, two maintenance employees, and a half-time office assistant who is assisting us tonight with this meeting as well. Thank you, Darcy. And then the airport, we talked a little bit earlier, supports nearly 40,000 annual aircraft operations. Those of you not familiar, an operation is either a takeoff or a landing. So if you would just divide 40,000 in half, we have roughly 20,000 aircraft that use the airport in any given year. I would also add that the airport is an enterprise fund. And what that means is that we collect all of our own revenues and we pay all of our own bills. There is no city general fund money appropriated to airport operations. And that's an important distinction because some people in the public think that we're wasting taxpayer money on the airport. So it's important for me to point out that really it's a user-based system, the folks that use the airport. And I would say probably 90 to 92% of our revenue comes primarily from the ground leases on these hangars and businesses. So it's really very much a user-based system. Let's see, next slide, another facility slide. This is a good depiction of the airfield generally. You can see pretty clearly both runways, the extensive taxiway system that we have here at the airport, connecting obviously the runways with the various ramp areas and business properties, and National Guard and so on. Several acres of paved aircraft ramps. We've got a lot here. I can't remember the number of acres, just the commercial ramp here. We just rehabilitated that last year. That's 4.5 acres just by itself. So, you know, probably 12 to 15 acres just in parking units. Of course, we've got vehicle parking areas that we have to maintain. The purple lines, you can see there's miles and miles. I think it's about a 6-mile perimeter fence around this airport. We also have a couple of off-airport properties. Not a lot of folks know this, but this piece right down here, it's kind of a shoe-shaped piece. It's a commercial industrial piece across the street from the airport on 25th and Ewald. That's actually airport property. It was left over from when the military left. And so we do generate revenue from the businesses that lease this land from the airport. And then we have another piece over here on the south side of the airport where Public Works has the construction waste transfer center kind of in the middle. This whole piece is an off-airport commercial industrial site too that we're currently working to develop the rest of the property. So we also collect all of the land lease revenue off of this parcel. And then of course the airport property. And so the nice thing is, especially, you know, then these two off-airport pieces, they're non-aviation parcels, but they help provide a stable source of revenue to the airport. And then, of course, they're not tearing up the pavement and using the airfield and those sorts of things. So it's a lot of airports are moving more towards non-aviation revenue generation to help support airport operations. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later in this presentation. But it's kind of a nice facility depiction of the size of the airport. You also see there's a lot of outer service roads and things out of here that we use to get to various places on the airfield, including an entire perimeter road. So there's a lot out here for us to maintain, particularly this time of year where it's very wet. Okay, next slide. We're going to talk a little bit about the airport business plan, and we've talked about this in our Airport Advisory Commission meetings over the past couple of years. It's a business plan that was developed because of a goal that was identified in the Salem strategic plan that council adopted back in 2017. There was an action item under the priority area of economic development that the airport create a strategic business plan. So staff received significant input from dozens of businesses, tenants, airport users, and other aviation professionals. Completed the plan in 2019, which then led up to the postponed City Council workshop that was scheduled for 2020. But the 6 key recommendations out of that plan, and the plan's available online. There's a link to it. I can send the link to anyone that really wants to read. If you read the whole thing, it's 600 plus pages, but there's about a 25-page smaller version. But the 6 key recommendations are prepare and market vacant land for development, which is something we are currently working on. Improve the airport infrastructure and amenities, including terminal upgrades. Parts of this building are now 70 plus years old. Increase awareness of the airport as a destination for aircraft operators visiting the Willamette Valley. Some marketing and outreach there. And we've talked about that a little bit in this group as well. Strengthen the airport's role as an emergency operations and disaster response hub. We'll talk about that again a little bit more, and Neil will have some, presumably we'll have some reporting later in the meeting. Pursue partnerships to support STEM and aviation-focused training and education, and then support the community's efforts to establish commercial air service, which of course, so we're really involved in all of these things now, but the business plan sort of guiding those and documented really what the priorities were for the airport going forward. So City Council, I don't know, they're aware of that the business plan is complete and kind of what the key recommendations out of it are. So we want to share that with them. The next slide is an economic contribution slide. And so it's interesting because it's not often recognized. If you can't fly out of an airport, if you don't own an airplane or you can't get on a commercial flight, there's usually a disconnect with the public as to what the value of the airport is in their local community. And why do we use 750 acres of land to, you know, let people fly their own private planes out, in and out? Well, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the airport provides 580 employees just on the airport alone. It also accounts for indirect employment of 846 people. So for a total of 1,426 jobs in the community that then equates to about $55 million in wages, and then another $243 million in direct and indirect business sales. So this is kind of a nice depiction of the example of the greater benefit of the airport to the local community. It's not just for those of you that are on airplanes or for those of us that have aviation jobs, but the folks that fly to and from the airport and they come and visit business jets, they spend money in the community. They help create jobs. So that's some information we like to share with the public whenever we have the opportunity. Speaking about other money spent on the airport, federal investment in this airport, we received a significant level of federal investment since 2013, a total of about $10 million in various rehabilitation projects that you see on screen there. That doesn't include the roughly $2 million we're going to spend later this summer on the other tax improvements. So it'll be $12 million in less than 10 years, which is it's a pretty significant amount for an airport this size. You'll notice that the projects are all rehabilitation or upgrades, which really kind of paints a picture of how expensive it is to maintain an airport. And obviously it wouldn't be, it would be cost prohibitive without federal funding. And so we're grateful to the FAA for providing the money that we needed to. We prioritize these projects in kind of an order of level of deterioration and need. The airfield electrical project, and you can look outside tonight and see how nice that looks. Then we did taxiway C and some other taxiway rehabilitation. We then milled and overlaid the primary runway back in 2018, although the grant was in 2017. And then we just did the terminal apron rehabilitation outside the terminal here this past summer. So it's a lot. It's very expensive. FAA airport improvement grants typically require a 10% local match, which would have amounted to about $1 million. It did amount to about $1 million of local match for these projects. And as I mentioned prior, the CARES Act will fund the required match for this year's project, which is going to save the airport roughly $200,000 in match money that we don't have to spend. So given our shoestring budget, that's a significant savings for us. But given that the airport fund, the airport operating fund, supplies the local match, it's important for me to let tenants know whenever I can that their land leases, for the most part, and fuel sales and some parking and some other revenue sources, that much of that is being reinvested back into their airport. And that's, I think that's important for people to know where the money's being spent. So. So we'd like to share that information when we can too. Now, when we take grant money, this next slide is going to talk a little bit about grant assurances. Every time we accept a federal grant, we agree to abide by 39 different grant assurances, which are ongoing obligations that we accept in exchange for the federal investment into the airport. Each grant acceptance, the grant acceptance resets the obligatory period for another 20 years every time you take a grant. So this coming spring, when we sign the paperwork for the grant award for the next year's project, we're going to reset that 20-year clock all over again. And any violation of the grant assurances can either delay or prevent future funding, or could expose the city to repayment of previously awarded grant funds. So these grant assurances are a pretty big deal. We don't want to be in violation of them. We wanted to highlight some of the key grant assurances out of the 39. The airfield must be maintained to FAA standards. The airport must protect approach and departure airspace. Airport revenues must be reinvested in the airport, so they can't be siphoned off to go to the general fund or used elsewhere besides on the airport. The airport should be as financially self-sufficient as possible, which we're certainly working towards. The airport must be open to all users of the aviation system. So that includes flight schools, night operations, all aircraft types. We can't discriminate against helicopters or flight schools or loud aircraft or fast aircraft or anything. We have to allow all types, classes, and kinds of aircraft to use the airport 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's always open unless closed for an emergency or for snow and ice events and things like that. We don't have the ability to have curfews or anything like that, not without FAA approval. And the airport must follow all FAA procedures when either selling or leasing our property. Most of our property is leased, of course. And what that means is that airport land and the buildings that they sit on must be used for aviation purposes. And as many of you know, that's an ongoing battle with some tenants. We're working diligently towards full compliance, but it's an ongoing battle at all airports for everybody to use their buildings for aviation purposes. And the other thing is that we have a requirement to receive fair market value for any property that has to be sold. And a perfect example of that is when the city upgraded the Madrona and 25th Street intersection out in front of the airport terminal here. The realignment of 25th Street required about an acre of airport property, which would have been used somewhere down the road for presumably parking or some other airport use. And so that project had to reimburse the airport fair market value for the loss of that property. And so that money went into the airport fund. And then, of course, the grant assurance says that it has to be used for airport purposes. And so these are just some of the key grant assurances that we have to ensure that we're in compliance with at all times. I'll take a quick break here really quickly and get a drink. At this point in the presentation, I would likely turn it over to Mitch Hooper on our team, but Mitch is not here tonight, so I'll just continue on. This next section will talk about trends in aviation, things that are going on that we're paying attention to. Some of you may be paying attention to them as well. But this is an example, and so many of these are occurring at a really rapid pace too. The way technology is moving, it's important for us to really pay attention to these things because they have the potential to affect future airport planning and development. This photo here is actually a scale model of Uber's eVTOL aircraft. And all those letters mean electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. So it's an all-electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. It's an urban air mobility type vehicle that's already been successfully flight tested at full scale. You can think of it in terms of like an air shuttle or an air taxi that would shuttle people to and from congested areas, helping avoid freeway gridlock. And so, for instance, if somebody wanted to leave Salem and head up to PDX, you know, they might be able to call an Uber Elevate and skip the freeway traffic. Boeing, Airbus, and many other companies are working on similar concepts and related technology. And so as we as airports think about future planning and as the aviation industry moves more towards electric vehicles, we have to think about things like charging stations and pods. You know, what does that do to your airport infrastructure? Do you need longer runways anymore? Or do you need more like helipad type landing spots and those sorts of things? So the folks at Mead and Hunt and then a lot of us, we track as much of this advancing technology as we can. This slide here, I won't get too much into the details, but this is from the FAA's aerospace forecast, 2020 to 2040. And some of the noted trends in aircraft operations, what they're anticipating on the left side here is a small overall decrease in active general aviation aircraft, mostly in the fixed wing piston category, which is the blue section here. You kind of see this decrease here, with increases in the red section, which are fixed wing turbine aircraft. Those of you not familiar with aircraft, you can think biz jets and other type of privately owned jets like that. A little bit in light sport aircraft, LSAs, which is the black line here. You see that kind of getting a little bit bigger as time goes on. And then also experimental and other, which is the green section. So growth in some of these areas, but an overall decline in the active general aviation aircraft. But then when you move to the right side, you'll see it's increasing the number of hours flown over the next 20 years. And again, you see a little bit of a decrease in the blue, which is fixed wing piston. And I know some of you here are fixed wing piston owners. You'll see a big increase in the red section here, which is fixed wing turbine. So a lot of aircraft hours being flown there. Some increases then in the orange, which is rotorcraft. Again, the black, which is light sport aircraft. And then some in the green also, which is again, experimental and others. So overall decrease in active general aviation aircraft, but more hours flown. So these are just charts that we use to help predict the future. And when we talk about what our airport might need, these are just some of the statistics that are helpful. Next slide is other trends in aviation that we watch are a lot of environmentally conscious aircraft technology upgrades. The aviation industry recognizes that it's historically been a polluter, a big polluter, and they really want to move to a lot less of that. On the left side here is actually an all-electric Cessna 208 Caravan that was successfully flight tested in Moses Lake, Washington. And I would note, if you look at the headline here, it's a Redmond-based company. So right here in Oregon, we've got some advanced aviation technology being developed. And it's interesting for us to watch that because, of course, Empire Airlines flies the 208 Caravan for FedEx. And we have at least one, if not more, coming in here. So that's interesting to watch. In the center is a full-size version of the Uber Elevate that we saw the model of earlier. This is the full-size version, and note here in the comments that it's due to launch in 2023, so it's only a couple of years down the road. And again, there are other companies that are working on similar technologies, and I suppose that as time goes on, these will become bigger pods, be able to carry more weight and more people. And then on the right side is an article highlighting Alaska Airlines efforts to move to more sustainable, renewable, and cleaner fuels to operate in their fossil burning aircraft. So advances in these and other technologies, again, will help make aviation less of a global polluter long term, which everybody is in favor of. So we pay a lot of attention to those as well. And then a particular trend that I like to watch, and it's important to to airports specifically, is, and I won't read you all the detail here, but in 2018 there was an FAA Reauthorization Act that was approved by Congress and signed by the President. And inside of that Reauthorization Act is a Section 163. And the long and short of that is that it's moving towards helping relieve airports of FAA approvals for non-aviation property development. So any properties that are authorized in this category that really aren't needed to be used for airport aviation development, and we talked about some of those properties here on the Salem Airport, would not be subject to the same extensive and very expensive planning and environmental reviews by the FAA as on-airport developments would be. So it's a sign to us that the FAA is recognizing that off-airport developments are a key revenue stream at airports, and that this section will help move off-airport commercial and industrial development forward at a faster pace, and also relieve FAA of their added regulatory burden for having to review commercial industrial developments, which they really don't want to have to deal with. So that's actually a big change, and we'll probably submit a Part 163 request sometime this year, subsequent to City Council workshop. And the upper right, this will be near and dear to our chairman's heart, but this is actually an in-progress photo of Garmin's call center as it was, the land was being developed for the building itself, the parking lot out here. So that's just an example of non-aviation development that had to go through the FAA approval process at that time, but that would probably not be subject to that going forward, and that would be a big cost and time savings both for the airport and for at that time would have been Garmin. And then in the lower right, this is actually an example at the Troutdale Airport here in Oregon, and what you'll notice here, whoops, sorry, hit my mouse. Is that they have reserved some of their property on the left side of the screen here, which is west of their airport. There's strategic reserves outside the airport and then airport reserve in blue. And then some other airport reserve here in their parking areas and some strategic reserve, presumably for more parking or more hangars or whatever aviation development. But then at the top of the screen, the north side of their airport is a section that they've peeled out for some type of commercial industrial development. And so it's an example of an airport master plan or an airport layout plan that would show, it would identify the differences between aviation and non-aviation properties. And our current master plan doesn't really define the difference between those two. It's all just shown as developable property. And so for the time being, we have to go through FAA approval processes for all development on the airport, both on and off. And so it's very time consuming and very expensive. So we'll be looking forward to making those changes. But Troutdale is an interesting one for me to use as a comparison. You can see it's a very simple one runway, very simple taxiway configuration and parking and hangars and so on. the size of this airport, they have roughly 100 to 110,000 operations a year at Troutdale, and we're at about 40. So it just goes to show you how much capacity you can get on a one runway airport. So we took the opportunity to just do a what if Salem looked something like that. We'll get to that in a second. But what I first wanted to show is an example of what our property looks like now and how we've kind of carved up our developable property in number of acres. And so we have this 10-acre blue piece, and the difference between the blue and the yellow is just zoning. It's public service zone versus industrial park zone. The 10 acres between Garmin and the National Guard is probably our most development-ready parcel. And we're looking at potentially developing that with some interested parties here in the next couple of years. And then the 14 acres that's over here along Turner Road past West Coast Washers is probably an example of a piece of property that's more suited to off-airport industrial development. It's such a long distance from the runways, and having to build all the taxiway infrastructure to do anything aviation over here would likely be cost prohibitive. This is probably our least developable piece of property. It's got threatened species over there and a whole bunch of things that we'd have to solve before we could develop that. These parcels down here I talked about earlier, this is off airport. We've got 4 acres and 8 acres on either side of the public works center. And we're working to develop those now to make them development ready. We had a grant from Business Oregon to help us prepare those sites and do the environmental work and all of that. Inside the fence, we've got down here on the south end where the corporate hangars are, we broke it up into 6 acres, 7 acres, and 8 acres, but it's essentially this whole 21-acre piece that we know is going to be aviation use. It's got taxiways in, it's got all the utilities in, it's all prepared for hangars. We built a couple of new hangars in the past couple of years. Then we've got this 17-acre piece in between here, and this is one of those that's an example of a piece of property that could really go either way. It's inside the fence now, but fences can be moved, gates can be moved, and this would be a piece that would be suitable for a non-aviation development. But when we talked to the FAA about that, they said, well, if you take 17 acres out of here, you're not leaving very many acres for future aviation development. And they have, they're very concerned about us releasing any additional property for commercial industrial until they're confident that we have reserved enough for future aviation needs. So the Troutdale example is a perfect example of that. If I go back to that again, you can see the reserved property for aviation use, and then they were able to release some property for non-aviation use. So Salem's version of what that might look like could just be this type of a concept. And again, this is just a concept drawing. It's a single runway, simplified taxiways system. You would notice that the secondary runway is gone and all of the associated taxiways that go to that are gone. And what this does is this opens up an additional 78 acres of aviation development here in the infield. That's 56 acres, plus another 21 acres up north of the National Guard that would all be ripe for aviation development closer to the runway. And then that would provide us enough aviation property set aside that we can take some of this property down on the south end and make a better case for release of that property for non-aviation revenue generation. So I just want to point out this is a concept only. I don't want anybody running out and telling people that we're closing the runway tomorrow or next year or even 10 years from now. This is strictly just a concept of how we can look at our airport, right-size the airport, have the added benefit of less pavement to maintain, less lighting systems to maintain, decreased operational costs, increased revenue, which then ultimately just leads to a more sustainable airport in the long term. So this is kind of an exercise we went through that's something that we want to think about going forward. Okay, with that, another trend, and this is really particular to the Northwest, is the value of airports in the event of a Cascadia earthquake event or any other similar natural or man-made disaster. We know that airports will be lifelines for moving people and supplies to and from the coastal cities over to the east side of Oregon, which presumably won't be impacted by a Cascadia type earthquake. You'll notice on the left column here, Salem was identified as a tier one airport and number two after Redmond. And so it was identified early on by the Oregon Airport Resiliency Work Group as a key airport to focus on. And on the right column here, you'll see that we were number two to get our FEMA assessment, which was done a couple of years ago. And so I have on my shelf here the FEMA assessment and airport operations plan for this type of catastrophe and where everything would be parked and what buildings would be used for what purposes and so on. So this is kind of just to let you know that the state of Oregon and FEMA, the federal government, sees Salem as a key airport. And so as we look at property development and the growth of this airport, and it is one of the six key recommendations I mentioned earlier in the strategic business plan, that emergency preparedness will likely play a key role in the future development of this airport. What that means and what that looks like and where, we don't know yet, but it's certainly a key piece for us to consider. Okay, that's kind of the end of trends in aviation section. Does anybody need to stop and take a break or anything? You like me to just keep going? All right, hearing none, I'll just continue on. Airport challenges and opportunities. So pilots of the airport, people that operate here, will recognize this view. For others that aren't familiar with this, this is sitting on runway 16 here at the airport looking south. And it's a great picture for a variety of reasons. But what I'd like to draw your focus to is that when you fly south out of this airport, you see all this rising terrain south of the airport and really southwest of the airport. And on that rising terrain, there's a good number of trees out there. And this has become a major issue. And we've talked about this in the Airport Advisory Commission for the last several years, trying to figure out a solution to figure out the order of magnitude of the problem and then what the solutions might be and how much that might cost. But it's already had adverse impacts. The airport spent nearly $100,000 already in studies to identify the magnitude of the problem and to find out if a viable action plan can be developed. But this is a great picture to kind of give people a visual of how the land rises pretty rapidly south of the airport. Departing is not as big a deal as landing, but if you can picture an aircraft landing from the south, having to get over these trees and hills and then down to runway 34 here, it's not an ideal situation. And so one of the things that we had to do several years ago on that end was take our precision approach path indicators. Those of you that aren't familiar with airport lexicon, this is just a navigational aid that sits at the end of both runways 16 and 34, and it helps pilots determine if they're on glide path to that runway. And what they're looking for in our case, these four white lights, they're looking to be in the middle here, which is two whites and two reds. And that lets them know that they're right on glide path. Not too low. When you see four reds here, you're too low. And when you see four whites, you're too high. So, but because the trees were such an issue, when the FAA flight checked this runway several years ago, they noted that the trees were dangerous enough that they mandated that we turn off the path beyond runway 34. That was our first inkling that we had a problem on the south end. Since that time, we've had identified a similar problem on the north end of that runway. Now, the primary runway does not have this issue. This is only the secondary runway, runway 1634. And this depiction on the bottom is just another example of kind of what a PAPI does. It's a different type of PAPI here, but I won't get into that. So we spent some money, we did some studies, and came up with these handy dandy little drawings. And I'm not going to get into the details here because you listen to me talk enough. But there's a lot of information here. On the left side, runway 16, the PAPI angle is currently at a standard 3 degrees. That's the standard angle for a PAPI. You'll notice that there are 16 red dots out here north of the airport. So this is Highway 22 across here. Each red dot represents a grouping of trees, up to about 10 trees per red dot. You'll notice the columns here, they're probably hard to see on your screen, but these are years, 2016, 2019, 2025. So if I look at the 2025 year, everything goes red, which means there are at least a minimum of 17 trees that exceed the obstacle clearance surface for this particular PAPI. On the right side of the page is the runway 34 PAPI, which is the one that faces the hills that I showed you earlier. This one was installed at a 4 degree angle, which tells me at the time of installation, this was years before I got here, that they recognized there was already some obstructions and that the 4 degree angle helped the obstructions be cleared at that time. Well, obviously trees continue to grow And so what we have here is a similar collection of red dots. There are about 14 of them, each dot representing a grouping of about 5 obstacles per dot. The 2025 column over here on the right side shows about 14 trees that will exceed the obstacle clearance surface, and they're on several privately owned properties. So we've got a problem on both ends, and obviously trees continue to grow. So this is just based on an assessment that was a snapshot in time at the time that this study was done. It's only going to be a problem that's going to get worse as time goes on. In addition to the PAPI obstacle clearance surfaces, we also have what's called threshold sighting surfaces. And these are just FAA surfaces that they use to ensure safety of runways. And they're measured and there's set dimensions and things like that. But the takeaway here is that even without a PAPI, this left side here is runway 16. For full clearance impact, we have 35 trees on multiple parcels, and on the 3-4 end for full clearance impact, meaning if we got rid of everything and cleared all these red dots, so at least 190 trees on multiple, again, privately owned parcels. So we were talking about over 200 tree obstacles penetrating into these siding surfaces. Other trees are likely to become a problem in the future. And so this issue, along with the wind coverage that was identified in the last master plan, has made this runway ineligible for any future federal funding. So runway 1634 for the past several years, all the maintenance costs for that have been all airport expenses. FAA will not fund any more maintenance, obstacle clearance, or anything on this runway. It's the full responsibility of the airport. And as we talked about earlier, it's expensive to maintain runways and taxiways. So it's going to be a problem that we're going to have to address going forward. But the next step we took in this study was to create an action plan. So I worked with Mead and Hunt, and we tried to figure out what's the magnitude and the cost of either turning the PAPIs back on or taking the PAPIs out completely, just making it a visual runway. On the left side here would be the next steps. We'd want to communicate with the affected property owners to request survey access. We'd want to survey each runway end to determine number of trees to be removed. We've actually done that once, but we would have to do it again. The numbers likely changed. We'd have to update the cost estimates accordingly. And then we'd have to obtain property easements, what we refer to as navigation easements, on those properties so that an easement allows us the right to access the property to prevent future obstructions. So we want to keep their trees down to a low or any other buildings or anything else. And without stepping through every single step here, because it'll take a while and it's pretty complex, but regardless of which way we go, this is runway 34 on the left, this is runway 16 on the right. And if you decide you want to remove the PAPI, you follow these arrows. If you decide you don't want to remove the path, you follow these arrows. And it's the same on both, but what this really boils down to, if you add up all of these dollars and cents that are in here, is that we're into hundreds of thousands of dollars to solve this issue, which is not money we have. And that would assume that all property owners agreed to let us remove their trees, which I would imagine is unlikely. People do like their trees. And many people would likely not care that it impacts the airport. That's the airport's problem. Additionally, this flowchart doesn't even contemplate the cost of property easements. And those are based on appraisals of property and some other costs. So there's other costs to have the easements. And then to go in and continue to remove trees long-term, it's gonna be an ongoing cost to the airport to protect this particular runway, which essentially is not needed for the level of operations we have and is no longer eligible for federal assistance. So it's just another challenge that we have to solve. And so we took that information and we put together this matrix, and it's really an opportunity and challenge summary. And what it is it's a pros and a cons of column one, which is we maintain that runway for the long term, or column two, which is we remove the runway. And it just talks about what are the benefits and what do we lose. It's nice to have a second runway. I like it when we're doing maintenance on one of the runways. I have a backup runway, and that's pretty handy. The tenants like it because it's a convenient runway. It's very close to especially the south hangar areas. If we maintain that runway, great. We keep two runways, and if we remove it, then Salem becomes a one-runway airport. The taxiway system is obviously impacted. If we keep that runway, all the existing taxiways remain. We'd have to realign several of them. Many of our taxiways don't meet modern design standards. So we're talking about tens of millions of dollars to realign taxiways for a runway that may not survive long-term. So we certainly aren't going to make that investment, because then we've locked ourselves into 20 years grant assurances to keep that runway. If we take the runway out, then of course reconfiguration of the taxiways is required, but ultimately it would be a net loss of pavement, which then is just less that we have to maintain. That's kind of this third line here, it's ongoing pavement maintenance. If we keep the runway, we've got to maintain the same taxiways, and if we lose it, we have less to maintain. Existing hangars would be impacted. If we keep the runway, of course, hangars stay where they are. And if we move it, then we open up all of that property closer to the primary runway. So some of the hangars would be further away, but we'd have room for infill development. So we could develop new hangar rows up closer to the primary runway. And then either keep the existing hangars or over time just redevelop those properties if that's what the demand calls for. In terms of obstruction removal, if we keep the runway, well, we've got to remove the obstructions. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If we take the runway out, trees can all stay where they are, and we don't have to remove any obstructions. Funding eligibility. So runway 1634 is not eligible at this time. We have to pay for all the expenses. If that runway goes away, then all of the remaining pavements, runways and taxiways, are fully eligible for AIP funding. Which is very important for us, because you saw in the previous slide how expensive that is. We need the federal assistance to be able to maintain this airport. In terms of property development, obviously if we keep the runway, we have the same amount of developable property, and if we were to close that runway, we would open up approximately 77 or 78 additional acres of developable property. And then future demand adequacy, we have plenty of demand now even for a one runway airport. So runway 1331 can accommodate all existing and future demand. It's roughly about 250,000 operations on a runway before you really need a second one. We happen to have a second runway because we're one of those airfields that was left over from World War II days. So we didn't build a second runway because we needed it, we just inherited one. So capacity on one runway is not going to be an issue. Again, Troutdale has over 100,000 operations a year. San Diego International, you know, runs 40 million passengers through their airport with their one runway. So it's not panicky to not have a second runway. It's just convenient to have it. Everybody likes more, but more costs. What I really want to stress here is this bottom line, which is the FAA is strongly encouraging Salem to complete a master plan update, and they have indicated that they may be willing to fund it as early as next year in 2022, and that will help us better evaluate and quantify all of these criteria. All this information I provided you is just our studies that we've paid for, but a master plan will better quantify and evaluate these and look at not just the secondary runway, but the property development that we talked about, identifying aviation versus non-aviation properties, and having a master plan that will serve the airport for the next 20 years. The last master plan was updated in 2012, and so it's almost a decade old already. And that master plan was really geared towards preserving all existing facilities, longer runway, setting up for commercial operations, and so forth. But what we've learned over the past few years is that we have adequate facilities now to handle the level of commercial service that we're likely to get here. In discussions we've had with SkyWest Airlines and United and some of the others, runway length has never been an issue for them. And so longer runway may not be something that we want to spend the money to build or have to maintain. So, but that's really what master plans are for. And so the AAC obviously will be involved in the next master plan update as much as it was in the last one. So that'll be a next step. So that's the end of that section. The last slide here is really just urban renewal. I am no urban renewal expert, so I'm not even going to try to talk about urban renewal areas. This will be something that Kristen Rutherford will touch on for City Council. But what I would point out here is that you see Salem Airport here in the middle of the screen. And it's surrounded by three separate urban renewal areas. And in particular, the Fairview URA, actually has a portion right here, if you can follow my mouse, that actually is on airport property. And it was part of the URA funding that funded the improvements on the south end that opened up that property for corporate hangar development. And so that's one advantage of having a URA here. So it is possible to amend boundaries. And if there's an effort to amend these boundaries to encompass a greater portion of the airport, that may provide us some funding to do more development on the airport. And then expend the rest of the Fairview URA money, and then they're able to close that urban renewal area. And I know that's something that they're anxious to do. So I'm anxious to help them spend that money on the airport if we can. So that's a little bit I can tell you about URAs. That's it. After that, it's just a thank you, and then questions, and then I'm gonna stop talking here, people.
I do have one comment, John.
You bet.
We're comparing Salem with Troutdale, and Troutdale, being on the gorge, has probably 99.9% of all their winds are going to be east-west. So
yep.
One runway aligning with the wind is very feasible.
Yep.
Different scenario with Salem, and where we would have a lot more crosswinds to contend with a single runway.
You are not incorrect. Our runways are separated out by about 30 degrees. But what you'll find in the master plan, the 2012 master plan, and this is where the other runway became ineligible, is that one of the criteria in there is wind coverage. It's a wind coverage roads, essentially. And I can't remember the percent, but we're well over 90% of the winds at this airport up and down 1331. And not enough of a crosswind on the secondary runway to justify. It's not a straight true crosswind where say you have 50% here and 50% there. It's greater than 90%. And so the FAA determined that we don't need a secondary runway, so they're not going to fund a secondary runway. So you're partially correct, but the wind coverage data that they collect as part of the master plan is what drives that determination.
Okay.
So, if you're ever interested, I can show you that it's on our airport layout plan. Bring your mask.
So is the general observation that there are multiple sources or contributing factors to that FAA ineligibility of 1634? Initially, it sounded like it had more to do with the trees being the obstructions.
But actually,
are there factors involved there?
Sorry, John. Yeah, actually what drove that initial ineligibility was the last master plan update, and it was the wind coverage, because we have greater than 90, whatever the number is, 90 or 95% coverage on our primary runway. The FAA can't justify spending millions of dollars to maintain what's not a true crosswind. So that was really the driver of it. The trees and the obstructions to the pathing and all of that is more of a secondary concern, although it's certainly more of it's a larger safety concern. But the ineligibility is just sort of an added-on ineligibility, I suppose. But the wind coverage is not likely to change. The winds that we get up and down this valley here are more or less in line with the primary. Other questions, comments, anything I can answer? And go back and I'll keep my screen up here if anybody wants to look at any other slides.
Yeah, John, talk about tree removal. Can trees be topped so they don't continue to grow vertical?
That's a great question. And we had the city arborist go out with us a couple of years ago to look at the trees. Most of them are Douglas fir trees. And I was actually shocked at how tall some of them are. They're up to 200 or 300 feet tall. And apparently these things continue to grow up to even 400 feet. But they can't be topped. If they're topped, they die. That was one of the first questions I asked is, can we just reduce the height of some of these? But if you do that, they're going to die anyway. So at that point, you have to take them out.
What is STEM?
STEM is, science, technology, engineering, and math, I believe. And I've also seen STEAM, where they put an A in the middle of it, too. And I can't remember what the A stands for. But it's all essentially the science and technology education.
Okay, thank you. You might use a larger mouse pointer for your demonstrations. Be easier to follow if it was larger.
I don't know how to do it. Is there a way to do it? I've never done that, Ken.
Well, you have to go to your settings and go to mouse. And
I'll do that. So actually, this is my first presentation in a virtual setting, so I appreciate the feedback.
Well, as your eyes get older, then you might want a bigger mouse anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting because it keeps disappearing on me here, too, and I have to kind of level it to make it show up again. So. Thanks for tolerating that.
No problem.
Were there any more questions for John on this presentation? All right. Well, thank you very much, John, for putting that together and sharing it with us. I'm guessing as we get further into this discussion of the long-term future of Runway 1634, there'll be a lot of interesting debate on that topic, I guess.
There will be indeed, absolutely. Yeah, it's a popular runway. Nobody likes to lose infrastructure. My airport manager doesn't want to lose any of it either, but my business hat says that we can't run out of money either. So we'll talk about those things as time goes on. The time being, I'll just say this, that runway is in really pretty good condition, actually very good condition. We just did a lot of crack seal on it this past year. We just painted it. It's got a life. I mean, we're not talking about anything that's going to happen in the next couple of years or 10 years or maybe even 20 years. This is going to be a long ways down the road as it kind of starts to outlive its useful life and the pavement maintenance becomes so untenable that it's essentially just going to be taken out. Or if the need for property development pushes it faster, that'll just be a supply and demand type of question. But it's my expectation that it'll be there for a minimum of another decade or longer, I would suppose. Well past my time here. So that way they can hang the next airport meeting.
Okay.
I'll put my screen back on here so you can see me smirking. Okay.
All right. Well, if there are no more questions for John, I guess we can move on to the next agenda item, which would be our action items. And we have two items to consider tonight. The first it's time to elect commission officers for the coming year. And there's a chair and a vice chair position. And what I'd like to do is proceed with initially with the nominations for the chair. Note that members aren't supposed to self-nominate. And then once we have nominations, we'll proceed with a roll call vote. And then following the election of the DIC chair for the next coming year, we'll then take nominations and vote on the vice chair position. So with that being said, do we have any nominations for the position of the chair of the Airport Advisory Commission? Neil,
go ahead.
Yes, I would like to make a motion for the chair position. I'd like to nominate John Foley as chair.
Okay. I don't know if we need a second for these, but is there a second?
I would say, Doug Brunheiser would second it.
Okay. Do we have any other nominations for the chair of the AAC? Going once, twice, three times. All right. So with that, we have a motion to the committee to appoint John Foley as the AAC chair for the next year. We'll do a roll call vote and indicate if you're in favor of appointing John Foley as the chair of the AAC. Doug Brenneser?
Aye.
Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe?
Aye.
Brendan O'Mara?
Aye.
Ken Geddes?
Aye.
Neil White?
Aye.
And John Foley will vote aye.
Okay.
All right. So then we have agreed that that I'll continue on as chair for the next year. And then moving on, do we have nominations for the vice chair position?
Who's current vice chair?
Doug Brunheiser is.
Well, I would like to move to nominate Doug Brunheiser to continue on as the vice chair.
Neil White seconds that motion.
Do we have any other nominations for the position of vice chair? All right, seeing none, we'll move ahead with a vote to approve Doug Brunheiser as the vice chair for the coming year. Doug Brunheiser?
I would vote for me, yes.
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe?
Aye.
Brendan O'Mara?
Aye.
Ken Geddes.
Aye.
Neil White.
Aye.
And John Foley votes aye. So you will, Doug will continue on in his role as vice chair for the AAC in the coming year.
You're both doing a fantastic job, so thank you for that.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
All right. Okay, so then the next item of business, John Pascal, I mentioned it to the committee or by email, but he's the airport manager has a proposal to temporarily suspend the airport site development fee for new tenants. And I think he'd like to present that to the commission. So if you could introduce the topic, John, then we can follow hopefully with a motion to support the proposal and then followed by some discussion and then a vote.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and I apologize. In hindsight, I probably should have sent a summary out with the packet. I will be more thoughtful about that down the road because I know you got some questions and I got some questions during the week. And my intent was just to present it here as I'm going to do tonight. But I realized that there would have been some value in having advanced information. What I would say is that, so the site development fee is a fee that's charged to new developments on the airport property. It's equal to 1 year's ground lease rent up front. So essentially, any new development pays double their rent first year. The purpose of the fee is really just to help offset airport costs for site development preparation, which includes environmental surveys for threatened species, staff time to seek all the FAA approvals for airspace analysis on behalf of the developments, all the lease preparation signatures and all of that. A long, long time ago, it was actually a flat fee. And then as I understand it, it was changed to a cost per square foot fee so that larger, more complex developments were paying their fair share, a larger share than a smaller standard hangar development. So it feels like a very fair system. But in recent years, particularly in 2020, and I think just because of the pandemic and the economic conditions that created, some potential hangar builders have balked at that fee because it obviously raises the upfront cost of development for them. And hangars are going to be more and more expensive to build as it is. And it's likely, I don't know this for sure, but it's likely that we've lost some new hangar developments to competing airports in the valley. As these folks shop around for the best deal if they don't have a specific need to be here, I think that we've lost one for sure and possibly two. And I think just the adverse financial impacts of the pandemic over the last year has hampered some of those development efforts. In fact, I've got two for sure, and possibly up to four new hangars that could be built this spring. They are waiting to see if council will approve the abatement of this fee. So to spur new development, staff is seeking city council approval to waive this fee for the next 5 years, at which time we will reassess the fee, determine if it should be a continuing fee or if it should just be completely eliminated. The developers feel like the fee should be eliminated and that our work should just be a cost of doing business at the airport. But it's an expensive cost, or at least it can be. There's no direct financial impact to the airport revenue to waive this fee because we don't have a line item revenue number because we don't have any way really to anticipate how much new development we have. So we don't budget for the revenue. It's sort of, I guess, found money that helps them reimburse some of the costs that we've assumed over the years. The long-term financial impact really is losing 30-year ground leases. It's obviously in the best interest of the airport to secure long-term revenue. And the thought of losing tens of thousands of dollars of revenue to a fee that amounts to $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever the number is tough to swallow. So that's really the purpose of it. In discussions with my chain of command, we talked about the elimination of it, but we thought maybe at this point it would just be better to seek a waiver of that fee, look at the economic conditions in the next 5 years, get a sense for whether the fee really did, or the lack of the fee really did, spur economic development, and then just revisit this in 5 years. So rather than doing away with it, we thought we would just request council abate it for the time being or waive those fees. So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any other questions, I would ask for the AAC's recommendation to council to waive the airport site development fee for 5 years. But ultimately, whatever recommendation the AAC decides tonight will be included in my staff report to council. Thank you.
Okay.
Question?
I'd like to move that the AAC recommend that to the City Council that the airport site development fee be abated for 5 years.
I ask a question first.
Well, if we can get a second on the motion, then we can have a regular discussion. Everybody can ask
questions. Gil White seconds the motion.
Okay. So, Ken, would you like to yeah. take the floor?
Does it have to be 5 years? We're currently in a pandemic this year, but that may abate in the next year, hopefully soon. So why not just 1 year instead of 5 years?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be 5 years. It can be any number of years. Our thought process there was that we know we've got some upcoming hangar developments this year, but when you look out to the time that it takes for us to do environmental surveys with the seasonal and to seek FAA approval, that can take up to a couple of years minimum to open up new lots for new hangar builds. And so I'd hate to have, I guess, a 1 year abatement, go through all of that effort and expense only to find out that it's a problem again in a year or two. So 5 years felt like a good time for us to really assess whether the fee really is a hindrance to development or not. But certainly the answer to the question is it does not have to be 5 years.
Question, John?
Yes, go ahead, yeah.
The fee that they pay for that per year, do they pay for the entire year up front? So that would cover the cost of evaluations?
Well, yes and no. So it's equal to 1 year's ground rent up front. So whatever their annual lease rate is going to be for the footprint of their lease space, they pay that up front. So essentially they pay twice the fee in the first year. But at the end of the day, the fee that we collect doesn't ever cover the costs that we incur. And really those costs, some of them are just soft costs. It's just staff time. It's my time. It's real estate. It's legal. It's, you know, reviewing leases and those sorts of things. So they're not hard costs. But some of the hard costs are like, for instance, it might cost me $5,000 to have a field biologist come out and ensure that there's no threatened species on a potential hangar site. And then to prepare that report, and then I submit that report to the FAA. So there are some hard costs. Ultimately, whatever we get back doesn't ever really cover the cost. There's no direct correlation between how much we charge for that fee versus what our costs might have been to prepare the property. But it certainly helps offset the costs in the long term. Okay. So for instance, it might cost me $5,000 to open up 4 hangar lots, but if I get, you know, all 4 site development fees back, I may have gotten all of that money back. Where I may not. And the rest of it's just soft costs in terms of staff funding.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
John, I have one. Doug Brenneiser has a question.
Go ahead, Doug.
If you mentioned it, and I'm not sure I know the scope, do other airports around us, the guys that we would consider competitors in a way, do they have this type of fee?
I have not found one that has this type of fee. Airports are, you know, when you've seen one airport, they're very different how they charge their rates and fees. Some may have higher ground lease rates and then they just recover their costs that way. But ultimately all airports, especially in a valley like this where there's a lot of competing airports, and you got Aurora, McMinnville, Salem, Albany, Corvallis, just in a stone's throw from here. Not to mention some of the smaller ones in Galeno and some of the others, and some of the state airports. Independence, of course, is right down the road. But all airports are trying to be cost competitive with one another. So we're all trying to collect as much revenue as we can without pricing ourselves out of the market. So I don't have an answer to that question, Doug, other than to say I don't think that fee exists at any other airport that I've seen. But they may be making an attempt to collect it another way, or that may be funded, you know, by their general fund or some other fund that they have that's supporting their airport. So it's hard to really compare an apple to an apple.
Okay, thank you.
I guess what I would add is that the reason this fee sticks out like a sore thumb to me is that it comes up or has come up probably the last 5 or 6 hangar lease negotiations that I've been involved in. And in fact, going back to even Garmin's development back in 2013, I sat with Steve Van Arsdale at length and had to talk about this fee and why they had to pay it and what the purpose of it was. And, you know, they grudgingly accepted it, and so have a couple of the corporate hangers, but it's easier for them to accept it because there's, you know, it's, I suppose it's just more affordable at some level than it is for smaller hangar builders. So, but the fact that it keeps coming up and that folks have said, okay, thanks, I'll let you know, and then they, and then I don't hear from them again, or in one case, somebody said, you know, it's just less expensive to build another airport. You know, the cost of the hangar presumably is the same, so it's probably ground lease cost and other fees.
Yeah.
That's my assumption.
Okay.
So we thought maybe we would test the waters, see if we could have City Council waive it for some period of time and then see how that does for us.
Okay, John, I call for the vote.
All right. If there's no other questions, I'll second that and we can move ahead with the vote. So I guess all in favor of recommending to the City Council that the airport development site fee be abated for a period of 5 years, we'll do a roll call vote and you can indicate if you're in favor of that. Doug Brenneser.
Aye.
Lieutenant Colonel Edgecombe.
Aye.
Brendan O'Mara.
Aye.
Ken Geddes.
Abstain.
Okay, Neil White.
Aye.
John Foley votes aye. All right, with that, we've decided to recommend to the City Council that the airport site development fee be abated for a period of 5 years. There was no other action items on the agenda, so we can move on to our next agenda item, which was items for commission discussion. And I don't have anything there other than perhaps, Neil, do you have an update on the emergency preparedness?
Yes, an update from our last meeting, because we had asked Deanna Henry and ODA, Bill Martin from OEM, to reach out to City Services Valcon, which is a distributor of petroleum products, to bring in AV fuel and even Jet A into Salem via the refineries in Montana, because the pipeline, which is our normal source of fuel, will no longer, very likely, no longer be operational after a Cascadia event. And so Bill Martin from OEM referred it to Scott Lucas within OEM, who's the operations and preparedness section manager. And his response was, and I quote, "We are in the process of extending out the contract by 1 year, the air consortium agreements we entered into in 2016 as well. Secondly, John Wilson and I, being Scott Lucas, will work with DAS procurement op once we are back to a normal work schedule." So we're just waiting for those wheels to turn more to get some kind of an agreement for fuel supply after Cascadia. The second thing on the flying disaster relief missions, update on that. We are up to 168 pilots that have volunteered for general aviation pilots to redistribute those supplies that are brought into Salem, also Eugene and Hillsboro. And to give you an idea of the capacity that general aviation can provide, using a Cessna 182, for example, it can deliver 2.5 tons of supplies per day. So that's the primary driving factor in getting avgas in here, because once you get all those supplies in, we don't want them just sitting on the airport without an ability to distribute them, which we won't be able to use overland methods. The third thing is that we really see a need to have the ability to generate electrical power, because the power lines will be down, according to PGE, for weeks and months, and that's backed up also by OEM. And so, to give you an example, if we were to purchase an electric generator, which they refer to as dual fuel, that being electricity and propane, the propane portion of it provides 6,750 watts of generated power, costs under $950. And the nice thing about the propane is that if we never put gas in there, when we go out and run the generator on a monthly maintenance basis, we never have to worry about problems with gas becoming old and turning varnish, etc. So I guess I would recommend to John that we purchase a generator. The size is up to their discretion, because I'm certainly not a subject matter expert on that. But there are also a variety of grants available out there to ease the cost of that $950 if that was a factor. And so that concludes the report for emergency preparedness.
All right. Do we have any questions for Neil? All right. Seeing none, are there any other items to discuss with the commission today? All right, if not, then the last item on the agenda is the chair's report, and I don't have anything additional to report separate than what we've discussed this evening, so we can adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much for all of your time, and John, thank you for all the information you presented tonight.
Thank you all. Happy New Year to everybody.
All right.
Okay.